We just ran out of time to finish chapter 14, which contains a prophecy against Philistia. Much of what we're going to study tonight involves nations that are right in the immediate vicinity of the land of Judah. And so you can see in this map, Israel is in the blue and Judah is in the sort of gold. And of course, the region of Philistia is just to the west of where the people of Israel are. All right, so it says in verse 28, in the year that King Ahaz died, which is about the year 715, came this oracle. Rejoice not, O Philistia, all of you, that the rod that struck you is broken, for from the serpent's root will come an adder, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. So to paraphrase, don't rejoice because you think you've won a minor victory, because what's going to come next is even worse than what you thought you have beaten. And the firstborn of the poor will graze, and the needy lie down in safety, but I will kill your root with famine, and your remnant it will slay. Wail, O gate, cry out, O city, melt in fear, O Philistia, all of you. For smoke comes out of the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. Out of the north, generally speaking in the prophets, that's the direction that bad stuff comes from. It's from the north, because from the point of view of the region of Israel, the north is where Syria comes, Assyria, and Babylon. All the major powers that invade typically come from the north, and the same would be true, of course, for a coastal power like the Philistines. Now, later, when we get to Isaiah chapter 20, we're going to learn more about Philistia. There was a rebellion that took place at the ancient Philistine city of Ashdod that the Assyrian monarch came and crushed. So I'll hold off more comment to that point. But I do want you to notice carefully the last verse of chapter 14, verse 32. What will one answer the messengers of the nation? The Lord has founded Zion, and in her the afflicted of his people find refuge. So in other words, imagine if you're Philistia and you're involved in a dispute with a major world empire, you're going to send out envoys, ambassadors, messengers to try to get other people to join you. And what the prophet is saying here is, here's how the people of Judah will answer. And the way the people of Judah are going to answer is to basically say, we're not going to trust in alliances. We're going to trust in God. The Lord has founded Zion, and in her, the afflicted of his people will find refuge. I mean, really, if you wanted to summarize the message of this first half of Isaiah, all of chapters 1 through 39, the essential message of these chapters is trust in God, don't trust in the nations. Trust in God, don't trust in alliances. And that's how this section here against Philistia comes to an end. All right, that was a little bit of leftover stuff from Sunday. So now we move on, and next on the hit parade is Moab. That's exactly right, and it covers chapter 15 and a good chunk of chapter 16. So it says, an oracle concerning Moab, because Ar of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. Because Kir of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. So just a little hint. At this point, and you'll see this kind of stuff all throughout the Bible, certainly in Isaiah, you have reference to a nation and to a bunch of cities that I have no idea how to even pronounce them, where they are. In fact, even today, a lot of these locations, nobody's exactly sure where they are. So in my mind, when I read these, I just sort of mentally substitute, what if this was directed to Florida? And then just think of major cities in Florida, just to get a feel for what the prophet is doing here. A lot of times, when you have lists of cities or villages like this, there is a pattern, often a geographical pattern. And that's the case here. For the most part, the places that are mentioned in the first four verses are in northern Moab, and then in the next section, they are in southern Moab. So if you all look up here on this map, I don't know how well you can see the letters. This is like an eye chart. Can you all read any letters on this map? Zach, can you see where it mentions the kingdom of Edom? down at the bottom? You can actually read those letters? Very good, because I can't read them literally right here on my slide that I'm looking at. That's fantastic. All right. So then just to the north of that, you see the purple swatch? Okay, so that's the region of Moab. Modern-day Jordan, basically, is in this region. So the idea here is something terrible has happened to Moab, and all of these cities moving from north to south are wailing, lamenting. In fact, I'm in the questions. I said, just make a list of all the language here in these verses that expresses this kind of mourning. And yet, notice verse 5. It seems to me there's a different tone here by the prophet Isaiah. Because if this is him indeed speaking, which it seems like in verse 5, what is his response to all this? Yeah, my heart cries out for Moab. You haven't gotten the sense in any of these other nations so far that Isaiah was particularly sad about what was happening to them. But he expresses sorrow here over what is happening to Moab. And maybe a part of the reason for this is because Moab and Israel, they have a complicated history. Anybody remember how does the nation of Moab get its start? Yeah, it's not one of the best stories in the Bible in terms of, like, if you want a really uplifting, feel-good story, don't read this one, all right? But in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, when Lot's daughters think they've just seen every dude on the planet incinerated, they think, if we're going to have any children, this is our chance. So they get their father drunk, and it's from those illicit unions that Ammon and Moab come. But because there is this national relationship, when the people of Israel are making their way into the promised land, the Lord tells them, don't try to fight with Moab. I don't want you to go to war with them. In Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 9. And then, of course, one of the most famous love stories in the Bible, the story of Ruth, of course, is about a Moabite woman and who ends up becoming a part of the genealogy of Jesus, mentioned again in Matthew chapter 1. So it may be that part of the reason Isaiah feels differently here may be because of this history. I think it's just important to see that the prophets are not mindless robots who just give these messages without any emotional or visceral response to them. It's tough to give messages like this, particularly if there's a relationship here. Yeah, Dave? That's a great question. Is it God or is it Isaiah? And we're going to have another question like this come up when we get over to chapter 16. So let me hold off until we get there, and then we can address that here for sure. But I think it's very interesting to consider that question and to consider both of those possibilities that Dave just brought up. Great. All right. So let's continue right on here. So what's being described here, you remember I said that these cities in verses 5 through 8, these are cities in the southern part of Moab. So we went from the northern part to the southern part, and they are fugitives. Do you see that mention of fugitives in verse 5? So the idea is, imagine the Assyrians invading. And of course, they're going to be coming from the north. And as they make their way south, you're going to have people being displaced from their homes, and they become fugitives, and they begin to go on the run, and it picks up. So, you know, maybe you've seen pictures of the ones that stand out in my mind are the pictures from World War II that I've seen after the Blitzkrieg and the Nazis would invade, in these long caravans of fugitives trying to get away from where they were. So imagine a similar kind of thing. And of course, the natural movement would be to go from the north down to the south. Now, in verse 9, we have one of those instances where translations will make a bit of a difference here. It's a minor point, but there is a bit of a difference. Those of you who use the English Standard Version, what is the name of the city that is mentioned in verse 9? And you can take your best shot at pronouncing it. I really have no idea. Dibon or Dibon, all right, D-I-B-O-N. Everybody else, you're looking at your Bible and you're going, that ain't what my Bible says. What does your Bible say? D-I-M-O-N. Yes, that's exactly right. Now, if you use an English Standard Version, you will notice that there is a footnote on this verse. Here's the thing. We know where Dibon, if that's how you say it, we know where it is. As a matter of fact, it's already been mentioned. Back up earlier in the chapter in verse 2. Nobody's ever heard in history of this place spelled D-I-M-O-N. So there's a couple of possibilities. One is it's just one of those instances where maybe as the scribes were copying down the words, and maybe somebody's reading and they're all copying. You know, sometimes certain word sounds can be confusing. So that could have been why in the texts of the Old Testament you have some renditions, like in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where it's Dibon, D-I-B-O-N, and then you have others that are with the letter M, as in mother. Another possibility here is that Isaiah is making a play on this word, and I think it's the New American Standard Bible. I tried to check them all. Does the New American Standard Bible have a footnote on this word that tells you about a word in Hebrew? Yeah, it's a word, it's be like the letters D and M that means blood. So some people think Isaiah is making a play, a pun, except it's not a happy ha-ha pun. It's like Dibon is gonna become Dimon. Dibon, the city, will now become the city of blood. And that really is kind of the emphasis here, right? Verse 9, for the waters of Dibon are full of blood, and I will bring upon Dibon even more a lion for those of Moab who escape. So you think we've escaped, and then you turn around, and then here comes a lion to get you for the remnant of the land. And then in the questions, I ask you to compare this to an account found in 2 Kings 3. It's just interesting. This is during the time of a Moabite king whose name is Mesha, in the time of, I think it's in the time of King Ahab. And, it wouldn't be Ahab. It would be one of the ones after him. And in any event, the Lord confuses the Moabites with an optical illusion that when in the morning sun, when it hits the water, it looks red, and they assume that this is blood, and they've attacked each other and killed each other, so now let's pounce on them and we can get the spoil. And then it turns out that's not what it was, and they are defeated. Some commentators think that maybe Isaiah's kind of making an allusion, you know, this idea of the blood and the water would be kind of an allusion back to that. In Moab's history, it's peculiar that you have this event that maybe the prophet could call upon. In any event, let's move right on ahead here, not to get so too bogged down in these details. If you go on into chapter 16, you can envision refugees from Moab looking for shelter. Send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah by the way of the desert. A lot of commentators think that that's a reference to Petra. Let me go back here just a second. Maybe you can see this. I don't know. This would be a real test. Down at the bottom of the yellow where Edom is, do you see, even if you can't make out the letters, that there is a city listed for you down there at the bottom? Okay, so that's the ancient city of Petra. A lot of people think that's what Isaiah is talking about here. And so imagine then the refugees have fled Moab altogether, and now they've headed further south. So the next place south is the region of Edom. Some of you maybe, have any of y'all ever been to see this? Any of y'all here ever been to Petra? I think Dave Willis may have. Anyway, they always show this picture. It's like there's only been one picture of Petra ever taken, and it's this one. Because if you Google it, this is the picture. No, there are a few others there, but that's one of the most famous ones. That's very true. In the Indiana Jones Last Crusade, you got to see a big tour of it for sure. That's exactly right. You know, Alan, though, I don't make references to pop culture when I teach and preach. I mean, how mundane and vulgar that would be, for sure. All right, very good. So he says, they're like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest. So are the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. And then here's what they say in verse 3. Let's just skip to verse 4. Let the outcasts of Moab sojourn among you. Be a shelter to them from the destroyer. So they're looking for shelter, trying to find a place where they can live and where they can be safe. Now then, all of a sudden, we have this remarkable promise. It starts at the end of verse 4. When the oppressor is no more, and destruction has ceased, and he who tramples underfoot has vanished from the land, then a throne will be established in steadfast love, and on it will sit in faithfulness in the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice and is swift to do righteousness. Now, we've talked a lot about when you read the prophets to always ask yourself, what time is it? That's right. What kind of time is being described? And the reason I find that helpful is because Isaiah, like many of the prophets, will switch so quickly from a message of judgment, like what he just described, Moab's going to get it and there's going to be refugees, to a promise of a glorious future, and then right back to judgment in verses 6 and 8, and make your head swivel off. Unless you just remember, this is how the prophets write. They speak in terms of kinds of time. Now, this king sits in faithfulness in the tent of David, judges and seeks justice, swift to do righteousness. Does this remind you of anybody described previously in this book? We've had a couple of significant promises. In fact, sometimes they are all categorized under the heading of the Book of Emmanuel. Do you remember what that is? 3 odd-numbered chapters. That's how I think. 7, 9, and 11. All right, so what's the promise in 7? Behold, a virgin will conceive. All right, this is like the Andy Griffith Declaration of Independence here, right? And bear a son and call his name. Ah, very good, all right. Then, chapter 9, a child will be given to us. The government will be upon his shoulder, and he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty Father, etc. Very good. And then the most recent one is in chapter 11, when it says in verse 1, there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, a branch from his root shall bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding. And remember, we emphasize this point, he judges righteously according to verse 4. So yeah, right here, smack dab in the middle of this pounding that Moab is taking. Hey, there's going to come a day when there is someone all nations can go to for refuge. There will be a day when fugitives have a king that is the true king who will judge in righteousness and faithfulness. So that's this promise here in chapter 16. And then immediately, we pivot right back to judgment. Verse 6, what is Moab's fatal flaw? Pride. We have heard of the pride of Moab, how proud he is of his arrogance, his pride, his insolence. In his idle boasting, he is not right. And this is something that you actually will see references made to in other prophets. For example, Jeremiah, we've heard of the pride of Moab. In fact, this sounds a lot like Isaiah's statement. Here's one from Amos. This is about Ammon and Moab. And after describing both of them, they're going to be judged like Sodom and Gomorrah. It says, this shall be their lot in return for their pride. So this was something almost like apparently proverbial in the prophets, as the fault of Moab was its pride. But it's not going to be full of pride any longer. It will be wailing in verse 7, therefore let Moab wail for Moab. Now, Dave asked a question a moment ago with regard to, in chapter 15, who is it that is heartbroken? Because it wasn't about them, it was about me, right? It wasn't third person. Back in 15:5, it wasn't their heart cries out for Moab. It was my heart, first person, cries out for Moab. Well, now, this is what I deferred you to, Dave. We get the same thing here in chapter 16. For verse 8, for the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmah, the lords of the nations, have struck down its branches, and so forth. Verse 9, therefore I weep with the weeping of Jazer for the vine of Sibma. I drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Eleah, for over your summer fruit and your harvest, the shout has ceased and joy and gladness are taken away. Very common image now of judgment in the Old Testament is when you're wiped out, you can't enjoy what you've planted, you can't enjoy your harvest, somebody else will get it. A pretty common image. So now we have that same question. Who is it that is weeping over the fall of, in this case now, once again, it is Moab. And the options are God or Isaiah. And we understand, of course, from a certain point of view, that those aren't mutually exclusive, because when the prophets speak, their message is, thus says the Lord. So sometimes it can be hard to distinguish when is this the word of the prophet grieving and when is this the Lord grieving. But I do think there is a very important practical point that we should take from this. And that is our attitude when we consider what will happen to those who will face the judgment of God, which should not be gleeful, but having that kind of broken heart that Jesus has when he comes to Jerusalem the final week, and it says, he said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who were sent to her, how often I would gather you as a chicken gathers the hens under her wing, the hen gathers the chicks under the wing, and you were unwilling." Jesus' heart broke. Luke specifically says he wept as he considered what was going to happen to the city. So I remember I heard this story about an old preacher describing two pioneer preachers. And the way they were described was like this: when brother so-and-so preaches about hell, he seems like you're happy you're going there. But when brother so-and-so preaches about it, he's heartbroken to think that you might go there. And that's Isaiah. You know, we think of Jeremiah as the weeping prophet, but all of these people were affected by considering the ramifications of this kind of judgment. Now, if you come to the last part of this, we even have a historical or chronological note as to when this will happen. Verse 13, "This is the word the Lord spoke concerning Moab in the past, but now the Lord has spoken, saying, in how many years?" 3 years. And not just 3 years, 3 years like what? The hired worker. What does that mean? Yeah, he's on time, and he knows exactly how much he's been paid for, and not one day over. I made a terrible decision back earlier in the fall. I have a friend named Philip Martin. Some of you know his son Jesse. Jesse worshiped with us last year. He said, "I'd like to do a Bible study with you on the nature of God. I noticed that you taught a class on this at Valrico." And I said, "Well, sure." So he said, "Send me your lessons." So I sent him like 19 lessons, thinking he would pick like, you know, 5, 6. 5 minutes later, I get this invitation to 19 consecutive Sunday afternoon classes I'm supposed to teach. And so instead of being able to take a little bit of a break and relax on Sunday afternoon, I had 19 consecutive Sunday afternoon naps ruined by Philip Martin. And I will tell you this, I was counting down every one of those classes. And when I got to number 19, that was it. I wasn't doing one more. So that's the idea here, is it's the hired man. He's been paid to do a job. He's not going to work free for overtime. And so the idea is it will be 3 and no more than 3 years. Now, as it turns out, in the year 715, Moab was invaded by Assyria. So if you wanted to work backwards, that may mean that this prophecy was given in the year 718 or something along those lines. Yeah. So Moab is going to get it. All right. Any questions or comments up through chapter 16? That's the the discussion of Moab. Yeah, Eric?
Just going back a little bit.
Yeah.
In verse 9 where it said, their eyes were weak.
Yeah.
We were talking about whether that was Isaiah or God.
Yeah. And so therefore, you would presume that maybe that means verse 9 is Isaiah. Ben, that was your point, right? Yeah, I think Eric made a really good argument. Did y'all catch what he was saying? There's two eyes. There's the eye in verse 9, I weep with weeping. And then there's the one at the end of verse 10, I have put an end to the shouting. So that maybe sounds more stern, maybe would be the way to put it. And if that is the case, and that is obviously God, it's very astute. Very astute observation, because commentators make this very argument that might mean that verse 9 is Isaiah. The other thing, though, to consider is that, and I may tend to agree with you, Eric, but if I was going to argue the other side, I might say that it is possible for God both to render punishment and, we might say, be heartbroken about it. That's not his ultimate objective. I do think you're probably right here, but we might think of other places, though. And we've kind of made this point even in the letter, in the book of Isaiah, that God's judgment, even for Israel, his intention is never for judgment to have the final word. There might be a time when shouting ends, celebration ends, but the ultimate goal, of course, is redemption for their deliverance. But no, I think that's a really good, really good argument. That's great. Any other comments up through chapter 16? All right, so chapter 17, who's up to the plate next? Syria, or your Bible may say Aram. I think that's how the New American Standard, if I remember right, how it typically translates this. And the capital of Syria is Damascus. And of course, we've already learned a little bit about Syria previously in this book because of what event, what conspiracy, what international shenanigans take place. There is an alliance, that's right. Syria and northern Israel make an alliance to attack Judah. So we've been introduced to Syria previously here. Okay, verse 1, chapter 17, an oracle concerning Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease to be a city and will become a heap of ruins. The cities of Aurora are deserted. They will be for flocks which lie down and none will make them afraid. Language we've seen before, nothing left but scavengers. But then notice he starts to segue from Syria to Israel, because he says in verse 3, the fortress will disappear from Ephraim. Remember, that's the tribe that is sort of the largest, most centrally located tribe in Israel. And the kingdom from Damascus and the remnant of Syria will be like the glory of the children of Israel, declares the Lord. And in that day, the glory of Jacob. So now he's full on hammering Israel, will be brought low, and the fat of his flesh will grow lean. It's kind of like, you ever know somebody goes off on tangents, and there's just some axe they have to grind, and they'll always get back to it. I hope our video doesn't have a pan right now with the whole audience. Somebody was just isolated as having axes to grind. So it's kind of like the prophet. I'm going to talk about Syria, but boy, you people in Israel, you really get under my skin. You know, it's like that. Like, I can't say enough about how terrible it was for what Israel to do. Yes.
Syria, are they not.
That's a great question. I try to always overpronounce the Syria as to distinguish from Syria. So if you look on this map, Tommy, you may not be able to read the letters, but if you see sort of the, greenish, aqua, marine, whatever color up at the very top, that's the region of Syria. Assyria is just to the north and then way bigger than that. Yeah. So those are, they're two different. Okay. Matter of fact, the alliance between Syria and Israel was an alliance against the Assyria. All right, so it shifts then here to Israel in verses 4 through 6 when the Lord is going to punish them. But given what we know about chapter 7, you can understand why the prophet would immediately connect in his mind Syria with Israel, because they were the ones who had been in cahoots with each other. And then all of a sudden, we have this shift, verse 7. In that day, man will look to his maker, and his eyes will look on, Isaiah's favorite description of God, the Holy One of Israel. He will not look to the altars, the work of his hands, and he will not look on what his own fingers have made, either the Asherim, those are the female consorts for Baal, or the altars of incense. So once again, we have this abrupt move from coming judgment to future glory. See how that happens? And then we're going to go right back to coming judgment in verse 9. But I'll just point out to you that in verses 7 and 8, we are being presented with what is always the most fundamental question in the Bible. The most fundamental question. Will we trust in the maker or in the things made? That's the question. Will we trust in the creator or creation? If we trust in the creation, if we trust in the things made, we are guilty of idolatry, whether it's a statue or it's abstract things that we make, like power, politics, military might, etc. Or will we trust in the maker? Now, part of our trust in the maker is we know he can work through these things, and he can work through people, of course, we know that. But the ultimate focus of our trust has to be on the maker and not on the things made. So then, right after this hopeful note that someday people will figure this out, verse 9, in that day their strong cities will be like the deserted places of the wooded heights and the hilltops, which they deserted because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation. For you have forgotten the God of your salvation, and have not remembered the rock of your refuge. Therefore, though you plant pleasant plants and sow the vine branch of a stranger, though you make them grow on the day that you plant them and make them blossom in the morning that you sow, yet the harvest will flee away in a day of grief and incurable pain. Again, the typical punishment that's described in the Bible of you'll plant, but before the harvest comes, you'll be out of there. Somebody else will come and take them away. Then after, you know, we've had these very specific prophecies directed to nations, then in verse 12, do you see how the language seems to expand out? What language is expansive in verse 12? Many nations, many peoples. Yes, that's right. And so it's as if the prophet takes this point sort of kind of midway through these chapters, remember 13 through 23, directed to these different nations. It's almost as if he takes this opportunity to just expand the point out. In fact, we even made this point with the very first nation, with Babylon in Isaiah 13. A lot of the language even there sounded worldwide in its scope, almost like Babylon is a symbol of the world as opposed to God. So listen to this. Verse 12, I hate this translation. The ESV here says, ah. Ah. But it's the word that otherwise is translated, woe. That's right. I think the New King James and the NIV say woe, right? I think the New American Standard says, alas, which is not terrible. But it would be great if they always use the word, because it's the idea of how terrible what's about to befall them. Ah, woe, the thunder of many peoples. They thunder like the thundering of the sea. The roar of the nations, they roar like the roaring of mighty waters. The nations roar like the roaring of many waters, but he will rebuke them, and they will flee far away, chased like chaff on the mountains before the wind and whirling dust. And before the storm, at evening time, behold, terror. Before morning, they are no more. Isn't that great? The nations, from our point of view, may seem so powerful. It's like this huge waterfall, or this huge hurricane, or a tsunami. Just seems like this powerful, raging, roaring torrent. But from God's point of view, it's like the chaff. And just like the Spirit of the Lord hovered over the face of the deep in Genesis 1, and just like that says, let the waters be divided, and they're divided. The waters flee at his word. Or in the Exodus, the breath of the Lord blows the east wind across the sea, and the waters part. All the nations, it's like in Psalm 2, all the nations conspire and brag and boast, make all this noise, all this racket, and God, just like that, can stop them in their tracks. Now, here's the point for Israel. Since the nations are going to get it, why in the world would you go walking to them for help? They got the same problem as you, and they're going to get it, just like you are. Don't be putting your trust in these nations. They're going to be judged too, just like you. Put your trust in God. That's going to be the only source of deliverance. All right, any questions or comments up through the end of chapter 7? You know, with a little help and some luck, we may just finish this whole lesson tonight. We'll see what I have. See who derails it tonight with a bunch of questions here. No, that's all right. So, chapter 18 pronounces judgment on the region called Cush. Sometimes spelled with a C, sometimes spelled with a K. It's basically what we would call today Ethiopia, which in the time of the prophet Isaiah had expanded even into Egypt. And so it's this, you know, burgeoning, growing world power, and it's looking for allies to help it fight off the Assyrians. A lot of times in the ancient world, the power struggle will tend to be between the great power in the south, which is Egypt, and then the great power in the north, which at different times is Syria, Assyria, or Babylon. And then, of course, who's caught right in the middle? So, you know, there's a lot going on here, all right? So this red splotch here kind of gives you the kingdom of Cush and how it expanded up north. So, woe, land of whirring wings that is beyond the rivers of Cush, which sends ambassadors by the sea and vessels of papyrus. Have you ever seen those, the ships? There's this old movie, Daniel, this would be one to put on our list, called Khartoum, about the fall of Khartoum. But anyway, it shows the ships that kind of look like, they look like they're made out of papyrus, and the sails look like wings on an insect. Go, you swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide. All you inhabitants of the world, you who dwell on the earth, when a signal, we've seen this language before, right? Isaiah likes this, the signal language, is raised on the mountains. Look, when a trumpet is blown here, for thus the Lord said to me, so we've got this empire sending out messengers far and wide. Hey, come join us. A lot of busy activity, like whirring wings in verse 1. The Lord said to me, I will quietly look from my dwelling, like clear heat in sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. In contrast to all of these political, diplomatic machinations, God works without fanfare. The heat of the sunny summer day, the dew of time of the harvest. But just like those cycles of nature come inexorably, unstoppable, they don't make big fanfare, it's just what is. By the same token, the Lord's power is going to come just as inexorably, just as unstoppably. And it says in verse 5, before the harvest, when the blossom is over and the flower becomes a ripening grape, he cuts off the shoots with pruning hooks, and the spreading branches he lops off and clears away. Somebody, like any of y'all in school, if you have to do a paper on Isaiah, you should do a paper on tree imagery in the book of Isaiah. If you think about it, we've seen a lot. It's one of his favorite metaphors. Verse 6, they shall all of them be left to the birds of prey, for you Star Trek losers. There's the birds of prey, the Klingon ships. And the birds of prey will summer on them, and all the beasts of the earth will winter on them. This is another image you see a lot in the prophets to describe an utter and total massacre and slaughter. Once this is over, all that's left is for the birds to come. and pick at what's left. Now then, in the midst of yet another message of judgment, all of a sudden, whoop, we switch to this positive note. Verse 7, at that time, tribute will be brought to whom? The Lord of hosts. From a people tall and smooth, from a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land there is dry. Same language. But now instead of them sending out messengers, trying to form alliances, they're going to be sending tribute to the Lord. And then to whom is the Lord and to where is? The very last part of chapter 18. To Mount Zion, the place of the name of the Lord of hosts. Now, what in the world could this be talking about? Sending tribute to God. The nations are going to end up someday sending tribute to God. Well, in the questions tonight, I gave you some different options to kind of think about how this could play itself out. We might even go so far as to call this concept a category. How could this happen? So here are some categories. Where are some examples you can think of in the Bible, or you can just look right on your notes if you have those notes in the questions, of the nations sending tribute to Jerusalem, to the people of God. How was the temple rebuilt in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah? He asked in a very leading fashion to the class. Yeah, remember Cyrus, king of Persia, not only allows the people to return, some of it's funded out of the Persian treasury. So Gentile money actually comes into Jerusalem to help rebuild the temple. That would be one way. Who came to see Jesus at his birth, and what did they bring? Yeah, you had the Magi, and they bring, you know, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And we'll see a passage much later toward the end of Isaiah, which I think could even be an allusion to this. And then in the book of Revelation, in the picture of, actually before I get there, this is one I don't think I put this one even in the notes. When Paul takes up the collection for poor Christians in Jerusalem, who's given most of that money? Gentile churches. And in Romans chapter 15, he even makes a big point about this, that if Gentiles have benefited from Jews spiritually, you know, all the apostles were Jewish, Jesus was Jewish, all the early Christians were Jewish, so Gentiles have salvation because the gospel was spread by Jews, then he says it's only right that we in turn should help them materially and give them money because they're in need. And then, of course, in the Revelation 21 and 22, in the description of the heavenly Jerusalem there, it talks about the nations coming and bringing what they have into the city. So it becomes like a category, if you think about it then. It's sort of a part of the bigger picture of the nations coming in, which we've seen this a lot all the way back from chapter 2, all nations will flow, you know. This is a common motif. It's a common theme, a common picture in the Old Testament prophets that in the glorious redemption, in the future glory, part of that future glory is this ingathering of the Gentiles, and a part of that would be they bring tribute. They bring tribute. And you could even think about the Ethiopian eunuch. Where was he coming from when Philip preached to him the gospel? Where had he been? He'd been to Jerusalem to worship. Maybe that's where he bought his scroll of Isaiah. You can't prove me wrong. So that's what I'm going to say. He bought a scroll of Isaiah, and he's reading it on the way home. And then he becomes a Christian, and then maybe he goes, and now he plants the gospel, and you could see that kind of thing happening. Yeah. So if you think in terms of category, the category of the ingathering of the Gentiles, and even financially, then you can kind of see many different ways in which this kind of concept is going to be fulfilled. You know, I think one big takeaway just as we wrap up tonight, I've mentioned several times how the prophet shifts almost like on a dime between judgment and then messages of salvation. I mean, I think there's just a good point here. It's not just unrelenting bad news. There is mixed in with it hope as well. And that's the glorious thing about the gospel. The gospel has a lot of bad news in it. You are a terrible sinner. It's hard to imagine how bad you are in the eyes of a holy God. What you deserve is terrible judgment, but then blended in with that is the sweet mercy that says, but God's love and grace is greater than your sin, and this is not how he wants your story to end. His hope is that the story will end through your redemption. And so you see that same mixture here in these prophets as well, particularly this section of Isaiah. All right, yes, Dave, this better be good. It's going to be the last comment or question, and we want to leave on a high note. Lots of pressure.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Going back to the discussion earlier about, you know, with God or Isaiah.
Right.
I get the impression that all throughout Scripture, God is the reluctant judge. From Genesis, where he cast Adam and Eve out, he says the penalty of sin is death. He doesn't kill him. He waits 900 years.
Right. Right.
It's as if we humans are just so thick-headed.
Right.
We don't understand that all God wants us to do is follow him so he can help us.
Yeah.
And the only reason he judges us is because we sin against him, rely on ourselves, and are just ignorant.
Right. Yeah, no, Dave's making a great point. It's a great way to close out tonight. In our college class last year, we were talking about God's anger. And the way we described it in class is God's love is asymmetrical to his anger. What does that mean? Asymmetrical. It means that if I go to the seesaw with Garrett and we both get on it at the same time, the results will be asymmetrical. One is much more than the other, all right? And I think I may have mentioned this even to you a couple weeks ago. I read a commentator, he had this great line with something like this: God is love, God does judgment. See the difference? God in his essence is love. Sometimes his holy love encounters sin, and that's judgment. But God's intention is always for judgment to produce redemption, which means that if that doesn't happen, whose fault is it? It's ours. If we are saved, whose fault is it? God's. Yeah, and that's the message here of these prophets. So Dave, you chose wisely tonight, all right, with your comment. All right, guys, well, I guess that's going to be it for tonight. Thank you all so much. Really enjoying the chance to study with you, and look forward to continuing on, Lord willing, on Sunday.